football on Off the Ball.
So he brought Max Damon on, who's not 16 until December, by the way. It's sort of ridiculous. I can't really explain it, to see a 15-year-old come on and do what he did.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by William Hill. Download the app and play today. 18+ gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
Right then, the first weekend of the Premier League season is in the books in terms of the perceived title contenders. It was a good start for Liverpool, for Manchester City and for Arsenal, all of them picking up 3 points. Chelsea, meanwhile, had to settle for a draw. Miguel Delaney of the London Independent is with us on the line. Miguel, how are you doing?
Not too bad. I was at one of the worst of those games, which is a all draw.
There's always a temptation to start these conversations with the game that you were at, but we might just put Chelsea versus Crystal Palace on ice for just a moment, and we'll start with the proceedings at Old Trafford. So Manchester United 0, Arsenal 1. The perceived analysis of this game seems to be Groundhog Day stuff. Arsenal score with a set piece, they keep a clean sheet, and it's the same old story once again. However, for Manchester United in particular, Miguel, I suspect there are a few signs of hope and a few things that they might be pretty optimistic about despite the loss yesterday.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's been a bit of an interesting debate about this because I've seen a lot of commentary about how if United are happy with a 1-0 defeat now at home to one of their historic rivals, what does that say about the club? But, I mean, like they're coming off a season of historic failure for the club, really. 15th in the table, could have been worse. And obviously, very difficult context where the manager, who they've, I suppose, put a lot of stock in now, didn't have the time because of that European campaign to impose any sort of system. And they are playing one of the best teams in Europe, no matter how people kind of laugh at some of Arteta's comments. And I agree. I think it was a good performance. I think United actually can feel a bit frustrated because it felt like Arsenal were there for the taking. It's funny, from speaking to people within football since, and even kind of some within Arsenal, there's a bit of a feeling that United's pressing was actually pretty good, which is a noted improvement from last season. But there's still an element of they've got better attackers onto the pitch now, but it's not immediately clear what they're trying to do in attack. There's still a bit of kind of, you know, individual creativity about it rather than a kind of defined system in the way Arsenal will be like at their best. But I think that will come with time. It's been a bit of a strange preseason for a lot of clubs. Also, I mean, it's clear that even though United have bought three attackers to really change the entire focus of their forward line, obviously only two of them started because Sesko's just signed, and they need a midfielder, at least one, if anything, to kind of change the whole balance of the team. So they've work to do. But like, I do think the most basic thing you can say, there was progress from last season. And I know people might immediately respond, well, actually, they drew at Arsenal last season, but the performance wasn't like that. And that was a bit of a dead rubber game for the Premier League because, like, obviously it was towards the end of the campaign when Arsenal knew they weren't going to win the title, were fairly sure of second place. This is a completely different sort of match. And they were good in it, I think. I'd actually be a little bit mildly concerned for Arsenal. Like, I don't think they haven't. It's not like they won the game, obviously, and it was a tough game to win. That alone is good, but it was quite it was a tepid performance. I think they were really lacking in the intensity you'd associate with Arsenal at their best under Arteta, and that's actually something. I mean, that was an issue last season. Obviously, one of the big themes of this campaign is how Arsenal have signed the kind of strength and depth to actually be able to sustain that level. And fair enough, I think maybe some of the approach to this match was circumstantial, but it would want to get better. There's obviously been a lot of comments about Gyökeres. It's far too soon to judge him, to be honest, especially given he himself had a stunted preseason because of the situation at Sporting.
Yeah, he didn't even have a shot yesterday. It was the first time in a league match for Gyökeres that he hasn't had a shot since April 2023, when he's playing for Coventry City against Blackburn, although he does get taken off yesterday. So maybe that comes with its own set of circumstances as well. And defending an early lead as well probably changed how Arsenal played. But like, it definitely felt last season, Miguel, you know, Arsenal were definitely missing a striker who scored 20, 25 goals. But I'm not necessarily sure there was a whole heap of missed opportunities week in, week out. There are some moments where strikers maybe didn't have a sharp touch in front of goal late on in the season, certainly against Paris Saint-Germain. There were a couple of missed opportunities by Martinelli and Trossard that always come to mind. But there wasn't actually a situation here where you're thinking to yourself, geez, just tap it in if there was a better number nine there. I think the attacking problems actually went a lot deeper than that.
The thing with Arsenal, to be fair to them, so in the 23-24 season, when they get 83 points and take, or sorry, it was 89 points and take City, to, you know, as far as you can pretty much take them. 89 points is actually a massive haul. It's very rare it doesn't win the title. And they also scored 91 goals that season. And that was on the forward, like that was without a striker. And it was with this kind of like this forward line that they've still got of Saka, Odegaard, Martinelli and Havertz. And in that season, and I think this is relevant that they played yesterday, just from speaking to people within Arsenal, they would say, even in that season, they didn't get their pressing system right. And one of the reasons that Arteta loves Havertz is because he really gets how they want to press, especially all the triggers and how that works. They didn't get that right until Christmas of that year. And actually, if you look at their record that season, it wasn't until after Christmas that they actually went on a proper unbeaten run. And they obviously scored a lot of goals. So this is what I mean, I suppose, about like Arsenal, if they have all their best players out, and it was the case occasionally last season, which is so rare that they had them, it's still very high. The question is sustaining it. And that's why I think they got Gyökeres, say, for €65 million, rather than going all out on something like Isak, because I don't think Arteta necessarily sees a striker as actually a fixed player. I think he'll be alternated with Havertz a lot. I think he's going to experiment with multiple different attacks this season. And it could be a case of Gyökeres, like, you know, being used in certain games, Havertz being used in other games. I was a little surprised he started yesterday. Maybe that's part of getting him up to speed. But yeah, Arsenal do have to, I suppose, rediscover that verve a bit.
When it comes to Manchester United's control in this game yesterday, you look through the stats line, 61% possession, 22 shots. I think that's the most they've had in a game against Arsenal since they beat them 8-2 that time. So that's it's an uptick on previous years against Arsenal. But if we go back to them actually establishing a foothold in the game and like having more ball against Arsenal, more shots against Arsenal than they usually tend to do, you immediately start to think about the midfield, and it definitely feels like they need an upgrade potentially on Casemiro, and if Bruno Fernandes is going to be playing in that position, maybe you could find somebody better out there as well. I know Manuel Ugarte is likely to start as the season progresses, but how come they seem to have a bit more control than we expected yesterday, I wonder?
I think Arteta actually got his tactics wrong in this game a little bit. Now, I know they won, so people will immediately say, but as you say, like, they didn't have control of the game in that area. And there was a lot of kind of bouncing ball moments that could have gone a different way in the actual match. And then suddenly your tactics don't look right. And yeah, I think Arsenal did feel like they were much more willing to play on the transition and the break, which obviously is an issue because Gyökeres isn't kind of fully fit with them in that approach yet. And that meant seeding midfield. And one of the things I have to say I did like about United throughout the game was they did feel a much better aggression about them. I mean, there were times last season, this is related to the lack of goals and maybe the kind of the way it was the early stages of trying to instill Amorim's system. But they felt like there was a really flat element to their attack, apart from when Amad Diallo played. Whereas in this game, you really did feel like a team that was willing to, you know, push between the lines a lot. Cunha was really willing to kind of seize the game. And I think that obviously played a part in kind of like how they did feel more proactive in midfield. So yeah, but they do still need something there. Amorim really wants something there. He absolutely wants a midfielder. It's just Belhiba, who they have identified as best fitting all the physical profiles they like and technical profiles they like. He's not affordable this window unless they made some sort of massive sale, which can't really see happening right now.
The John Giles era with Off the Ball has come to an emotional end.
Off the Ball wouldn't exist the way it does without the existence of John Giles.
Helped by a plethora of John's friends and family within and without football, we pay tribute to the great man in front of a selected audience.
So we are here tonight to celebrate not just the impact John has had on Off the Ball over the last 20 years or so, but really the unrivaled impact that he's had on Irish football going back 70 years.
This week in the OTB football feed, look out for the full John Giles tribute night.
If we didn't say John was the best player I've ever played with, he would tell you why he was.
Eddie, I might come to that in a minute. Yeah. Yeah.
We speak to John himself about his 7 decades in football, former Leeds teammates Eddie Gray and Joe Jordan, plus tributes from Liam Brady, Brian Kerr and many more.
As you say, it's what, 20 odd?
23 years.
20 years. Well, they did well to put up with me for 20 years.
Released in three parts, we'll drop the first part of the John Giles tribute night on Tuesday morning. And to mark the occasion, it will be available for free for a limited time only. The John Giles tribute, only available in your OTB football feed.
I wonder if another factor in this, and we'll learn a little bit more as the weeks go by, is the attackers that Manchester United now have. Mbeumo and Cunha both looked pretty good yesterday. And maybe just forces Arsenal to take a step back, a touch, compared to dealing with last year's Manchester United attackers, and just having a more potent attack, or at least a seemingly potent attack, is something that opposition defences and midfields are going to have to think about.
Yeah, I think there was undeniably an element of that. And also, I suppose, like, because again, I was talking to people at Arsenal the week before the season, and they were saying how one of Arteta's qualities, even if it can kind of like cause kind of joking eyebrow raising among those around him, is that he really goes intense on considering absolutely every possibility for a game. He, like, you know, compiling videos that he's often like involved in compiling for every individual player that comes on. It's very Pep Guardiola like. And like, as the phrase was put to me that I wrote last week, he almost gives himself a headache considering all this. So in that sense, yeah, it's inevitable then that when suddenly he's faced with an attack that he's not actually used to, because this is a new team put together for United, that obviously there may be that bit more restrained, especially, I suppose, if Arsenal feel they can beat United in other ways, as they did with that set piece. So from that point, I suppose you can say, yes, the tactics did work, if not necessarily in midfield.
Goalkeeper is a massive issue for Manchester United at this point. Bayindir, Onana, neither of them are going to be to the required level, you'd imagine, this season. Is that going to be something that they might try and address before the end of the deadline, end of the transfer window?
It sounds like it's their second priority. The next one is a midfielder, if they can get one in. But like, it's one of those where it's hard not to agree with Gary Neville, actually. Now, he was like, it's always a kind of strange thing about this element, this time of the season. And actually, one of the kind of the exhilarating things about it, I mean, you have like months of build-up where there's a lot of uncertainties that are fed in from the previous season. And we spend so much time talking about them, thinking about them when you're covering football. But then, and like, one of them, you know, United's goalkeeper issue, it's an issue and it has been for a while. But it's not until you actually play a first proper match that kind of you know it, but then you really know it. And you could see it with Bayindir. And it's a bit of a pity with Bayindir as well, because he is decent with his feet. Like, he's suitable to certain aspects of the modern game. But I suppose, as a lot of people point out, that doesn't necessarily mean as much if you're... I mean, he's clearly got a vulnerability in those set-pieces, and clubs obviously aim for it.
Yeah, like, it's actually a fascinating transfer window aspect at the moment, the goalkeeper landscape, because it brings into question Manchester City as well over the closing little while of the window, with the Ederson departure looking imminent, James Trafford stepping up, and the idea of Donnarumma joining the Premier League. It feels like this could be a Manchester face-off for his signature.
So, I mean, I know that there was like some contact about United and Donnarumma, say, but from everything you hear, Donnarumma wants extraordinarily high wages that in United's current structure they probably can't go to, which is why all that talk has suddenly dropped off. And the City, yeah, it'll be an interesting one there. I mean, I have to say, the Ederson decision, or just suddenly where, you know, he's potentially going to leave City, does feel a little bit surprising, given that he's been, you know, a totem of the team. All right, he wasn't as good in the last two seasons, but we are still talking about a player who's reached a very high level. And like, I remember being told as well that Pep Guardiola specifically absolutely loves Ederson's ability to play a ball half a metre off the ground for 80 metres. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe this is about just when you need to change a team in the way that City have that you've got to kind of you've got to just be willing to sacrifice big players and just change the chemistry.
You mentioned there, within Manchester United's current wage structure, it's difficult for someone like Donnarumma to come into the club and for Manchester United to be able to actually afford that. It definitely does seem that United are slowly but surely chipping away on some of the obscene wage stories that we've seen over the years. Like, I'm not sure who the current top earner is in the Manchester United dressing room, but if you look at Spotrac, it suggests it's Casemiro who's earning the top wages with Jadon Sancho.
The one thing on those sites, and we often get capology quoted to us. You can't, in terms of wages, you can't trust anything except basically the official budgets that, like, I'm sorry, the official accounts that come out every year.
Okay, fair enough. is there a sense that Manchester United are maybe paying way more attention to the idea of how responsible they're being with the wages that they're giving to players? And is that precluding them from certain targets in the transfer market?
I think inevitably, and we've all known their PSR concerns, even if those concerns aren't as pronounced as maybe they've been talking about earlier in the year, when obviously they were making redundancies, which obviously seem in kind of poorer taste given how much they've spent in the summer. And also where Jim Ratcliffe was talking about, you know, how they're potentially going bust by Christmas had he not made changes. But yes, they are more conscious of this. I mean, let's be fair, for about a decade there, United sort of did what, like, the nouveau riche in football do, which is to get over their kind of the fact they didn't have the same pull as they used to, or the other clubs had. They overpaid. And like, they overpaid in a lot of circumstances. And now they're trying to move away from that era. It's left them with a lot of residual issues, including kind of like a top-heavy squad. And also you can see in the sort of players they're going for. I mean, Ratcliffe has, in a lot of those same interviews, was talking about the data revolution. I think that's why they have gone for players like who from that kind of that middle tier of the Premier League, but also kind of proven Premier League players. I mean, that does feel like it's a big thing for them as well. They briefly maybe went a bit too far in terms of like Hoyland being a vintage example, and getting players who didn't have that experience, or players who were all about potential. I have to say, that does make it a little bit surprising that they went for Sesko. Good as he might become, like, it's the first season in the Premier League, and obviously this has been an issue with Gyökeres as well. That is going to bring different tests when you, especially for United, who need a guarantee of goals. And I know while this is kind of a simplistic one to say, it does feel like maybe just for this season, Ollie Watkins was more suited to what they needed, just because he is that guarantee of goals. Although Sesko did have a few moments, to be fair, especially with the way he ran and drove at the Arsenal defence.
Yeah, he looked pretty good for the short period that we saw him. As I said, you were at Stamford Bridge yesterday for Chelsea versus Crystal Palace. Not exactly a whole pile of incident from it. We'll get to the Eze free kick in just a moment. But first of all, the Champions of the World tag is something that Chelsea are very much embracing. It was present around the stadium in a couple of different areas.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that was always going to be the case, the Club World Cup, I suppose. And it's funny, having speaking to people, like, say, in Spain, about its status, and like, as they put it, well, for Atletico Madrid, it was the biggest competition in the world until they got knocked out in the group stage and it became a pre-season tournament. For Real Madrid, it was the biggest tournament in the world until they got knocked out in the semis. Then it became a pre-season tournament. And similar, like, I suppose this has been it for Chelsea. They've won it, so it's huge. To be fair to Chelsea, I think the performance has to be put in the context of that summer, which, like, they haven't had a proper pre-season. It's been a very different preseason. Maresca brought it up after the game. And I think it is, for both themselves and City, it's going to have some strange effects this year, just because this is a fitness schedule the players aren't used to. So I think I'd make certain allowances for Chelsea's performance in that regard. But there were still other elements about the game where you would question whether they can make this leap from world champions to English champions, which sounds a bit absurd as it is. But there's two things with Chelsea. One is, I always get to say, even though, to be fair, I think they have gradually increased the standard of the team through this constant trading. Like, I think that's undeniable. They've got better players now than they did 3 years ago. It still doesn't feel like they necessarily fully fit together in an obvious shape. And I think that is maybe compounded by the fact that Maresca obviously has clear ideas on how he wants to play. And that's criticised among a lot of Chelsea support for being too flat, too tepid. But also, I think there's another aspect in that. I think Maresca is clearly a good manager. He might prove me wrong, or I might be kind of like this might be thrown in my face at the end of the season. But like, I certainly wouldn't have him at Guardiola's level. He used to be an assistant for. I wouldn't have him at Slot's level, and I wouldn't have him at Arteta's level. And this is who he's up against with similar squads. And we'll wait to see how that goes.
Talk to us about the Eze free kick then. Watching it on TV, it felt that the anger being expressed by the Chelsea defenders and the goalkeeper was actually more to do with, you know, their lack of quality in that moment as opposed to any sort of injustice. So I was quite surprised when it was actually ruled out.
So someone from another club immediately messaged me as it happened and basically said, this is so typical of what we have to put up with. It's a rule that's being enforced And while, okay, you can see some of the logic for it, not least, I suppose, Guéhi's action, what they said was basically that no one in football complains about. As we put to me, you know, who was it? Caicedo. Caicedo just had to be stronger there, basically. And there's always this element in football, I suppose. Now, look, this might have just been a one-off in that sense. But obviously, suddenly, there's so much more focus on this law in the game, Law 13. And now questions over whether there's directives over whether to, you know, apply this much more rigorously. Although people, I suppose, will point to how Eze actually had a free kick ruled out on the opening day of last season. But there's also another aspect that once this happens once, it's suddenly, like, there's this kind of contagion effect or psychological contagion. Suddenly it's in the minds of referees and players. Will there be a brief period now where referees are suddenly kind of like all the more watchful of it? Will we see a month, say, where this is kind of called out all the time before everyone forgets it? I mean, that's kind of semi-connected to the other issue about the rules, kind of like this one about 8 seconds with goalkeepers. And like from speaking to people within clubs, they're all thinking, well, it's a little bit like kind of kicking the ball away that obviously Arsenal suffered from last year with Declan Rice saying against Brighton, that they bring in a directive, there's a kind of a zealotry about it for a month, and then it sort of kind of just is absorbed back into kind of the general way the game is refereed.
Is that actually because of behaviours changing, or is this a holding back of the zealotry?
So the PGMOL, and actually so on Thursday there, I was in the Premier League headquarters because we had before the start of every season, they sit us down with the chief executive, Richard Masters, and Howard Webb of the PGMOL. And like Webb was talking about how a big thing is actually conditioning behaviour. But given what we see with, say, players kicking the ball away, does behaviour really change? It doesn't feel like that. It does feel like there's a temporary zealotry. Look, they might have the data to prove me wrong there, but from the eye test, it doesn't necessarily feel the case.
Do you think you watched Eze's last ever game for Crystal Palace?
Ooh. Not necessarily, but only because I think the slow pace of this negotiation. So, like, it's been an interesting 2 days, I'd say, because I've been reporting on this a lot. And in some ways, that was actually merciful because there was very little to write about in the actual game itself. So I ended up writing about Eze a lot. On Saturday, I reported, and a lot of people reported, that it was getting closer and the broad fee had been agreed. It was going to be 55 million and a few add-ons. A lot of people are reporting 5 million in add-ons. I haven't heard exactly that. But then, to a lot of abuse from Spurs fans, I reported about 8 p.m. on Saturday night that it had encountered difficulties. I learned a bit later those difficulties were about the structure of the deal and how much is going up front. And that has significantly slowed things. So the point that I've reported today on Monday, that the two clubs did meet today and they're that bit closer to an agreement, but they still haven't worked out the structure of the deal. And the structure matters because, I mean, Palace ultimately want to be able to, you know, quickly go for Eze's replacement or replacements. They want much more money up front. And it's like there is an element with all this. It's like it's a bit like the housing market now, the modern football transfer market. And like especially when there's such financial stratification, where you know Chelsea buy a player off Palace and Palace buy players off the clubs the next few rungs down, and that's the way it goes. It's all dependent on that. So like the big one that Palace have been speaking about is kind of El Canoes from Leicester, but also potentially one more. But yeah, they obviously want to. And let's not forget as well, this is Steve Parrish and Daniel Levy, who are renowned as being hard negotiators. So it's no surprises who it is. Hence, I think we might have a situation where Eze plays the Conference League game against Fredrikstad on Thursday. But it did get closer today. That doesn't sound like an update, but it is. And the other one there, of course, is Guéhi, who yeah. Liverpool have obviously been interested in. But at the moment, there's a 10 million gap there. Liverpool only want to pay 35 million. Palace want 45 million.
Okay, we'll see how it plays out. Miguel Delaney of the London Independent, thank you so much for your time.
Cheers, Owen.
Cheers.